to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly. Home ownership is the central plank of the American dream, the idea that our ultimate aspiration should be to own our own house. And yet that dream, boosted especially aggressively over the past 15 years, has turned into a nightmare for so many Americans, unable to pay adjustable rate and subprime mortgages, leading to a tidal wave of foreclosures. Even today, one out of every four homeowners is underwater, meaning that they owe mortgages way greater than the value of their houses. Journalist Alyssa Katz has written about the history that has gotten us where we are today, in our lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us, published by Bloomsbury Press. She teaches journalism at New York University and works for the Pratt Center for Community Development, an organization that helps New York's low and moderate income communities influence city planning and development. She writes for, amongst other publications, The American Prospect, Mother Jones and Salon, and she joins me now from New York City. So I wonder if you could just start by summing up the American dream around home ownership. What does it evoke for people in this country?
Well, the American dream of home ownership, I think, has evoked this idea that one's property really became a reflection of a certain status in life, that showed that the homeowner was a fully realized citizen and had distinguished themselves from those who were not homeowners. It really is a mark of a full citizenship.
And yet, it might surprise people that these notions were not always the case. And in fact, going back, as you do in this book, Our Lot, to the 1920s, most people then actually were not homeowners and didn't expect to be, didn't aspire to be homeowners.
Yeah, sure. I mean, really, until the middle of the 20th century, homeownership was the exception rather than the rule. Home mortgages were really hard to come by for working people. Banks would lend money for a short period of time, and the homebuyer had to put a really significant amount of money down, often 40 or 50% of the purchase price. So as a result, people who did buy their homes paid cash or built their homes themselves if they were homesteaders or farmers, or they rented. There really wasn't any other option.
So in the 1920s, the U.S. was a nation of thrift. People did not expect or choose to go into debt. It wasn't part of the culture that you would borrow so that you could buy. How did that change in the 1920s?
Yeah, no, prior to the 1920s, you really still had the dominant overcast of the Victorian culture, right? You had the values that really held thrift and saving but not living beyond one's means as something that a proper household should aspire to. So the fact that working people did have difficulty accessing credit was sort of reinforced by the fact that the cultural values really sent the message that this was not really something that one did. But what happened in the 1920s was, early in the 20s, the nation went into a recession or began to go into a recession. And the way that big retail businesses responded to this was by building really the prototype for today's credit machine. And they did this around all kinds of household appliances that were coming into use through the, in the later days of the Industrial Revolution, washers and dishwashers and sewing machines and so on that one could buy on the installment plan. And most of all, what retailers, the biggest ticket item that retailers were selling was cars. So the automobile and the aspiration to buy an automobile really drove a lot of Americans who never would have thought of taking on debt to, for the first time, think, you know what, I really have to have that car, and I'm going to buy one on an installment plan.
and this model that you're talking about then, as you write, was seen as a mechanism for getting people to actually buy houses. How did that come to pass in that era, which, interestingly enough, Herbert Hoover played a role in?
Yeah. Well, what was interesting in the 1920s is that even though there was a real craze for credit and a lot of Americans did take on consumer debt on a large scale for the first time, and a lot of them became homeowners for the first time, you know, what you had going on then was still because, mortgage credit was still a totally private market affair. You know, there were still a lot of barriers for most people to borrow enough to buy a home. But what you had happening in the 1920s was two things, and they kind of came from the left and the right, to be reductive about it. And on the right, you had Herbert Hoover, who, before he was president, was a Secretary of Commerce and led a little mini movement of own your own home, really encouraging Americans to buy a home, furnish it, really get the economy buzzing with all these investments. So there was a national push on that front that Hoover continued when he was president. At the same time, what you had on the left was sort of in similar recognition of the power of ownership to be empowering for working people. You had a movement. Sort of realized in certain places, especially in New York City, in a development called Sunnyside in Queens, that tried to figure out how to make it financially feasible for working people to own their homes on a large scale. So they developed very attractive, uplifting community, and then provided low-cost, long-term mortgages that would enable working people to buy those homes. And that was really the first time that anyone had tried specifically to make that a possibility.
And then what happened during the Great Depression? So obviously, you know, the stock market burst in 1929, and then in the depths of the Depression, the government under Franklin Delano Roosevelt started a massive spending on public works as a way of stimulating the economy. Housing ended up playing a role in that, but in a different way, as you write, a way of stimulating the economy without having the government play such a central role.
Yeah, I think that the administration was looking for a way to really get economic activity going, and saw they were already in the housing market at this point, because one thing the Roosevelt administration did was create something called the Homeowners Loan Corporation that allowed homeowners who were going into foreclosure to get a new mortgage that was at a much lower price, that reflected the lower value of their property following the Great Crash. And they were seeing some pretty good results from that program. So they already knew that housing had some potential just to stabilize households' financial situations and stabilize communities. What the administration did was move forward sort of to the next logical step and create something they ended up calling the Federal Housing Administration, that set up an insurance fund that was paid for by a small fee on every mortgage. But really significantly, what the Federal Housing Administration did was created the first sort of mass marketed long-term mortgage. Started out at 20 years and eventually became the now familiar 30-year mortgage that's now the norm in the United States. So the idea was that a household could buy a home and with 30-year financing put very little money down up front, didn't have to already be wealthy to do this, and then could pay back the cost of that house over time.
Tell us about the formation of what has come to be known as Fannie Mae, but the Federal National Mortgage Association.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think at first it was kind of just a part, Fannie Mae was part of this larger project to create support for widespread ownership as an economic engine. And the idea was that, you know, one of the big problems in the banking business, and it really came to the fore in the Great Depression, was that you kind of had feast or famine with the amount of money that any given bank would have available to lend in any one place at any one time. And even this would be in even in good times, not to mention bad. It was just really difficult to have reliable pools of money to access for banks to lend out, because they didn't know how much in the way of deposits they might have at any given time. So Fannie Mae was another creature of the federal government that basically served to pool home mortgages in large quantities, to buy them up from banks, and then in exchange give banks more capital to lend. So it's just kind of a machine that that greased the wheels of the mortgage lending business. And for the first 30 years of its existence, to differing degrees, it was a Fannie Mae was a government owned and operated agency.
So throughout the 1940s, 1950s, following World War II, there was this post-war boom, and concurrent with it was a massive increase in suburbanization. People moved from the cities, encouraged to relocate in suburbs. What role did government agencies, the Federal Housing Administration, play in that reorientation of housing, and who was left out of that boom?
Yeah, so the government and the Federal Housing Administration played a pivotal role in creating the suburbs. I mean, what they did essentially was, the federal government indicated that it would only essentially provide mortgage insurance for new housing built in brand new places, i.e. suburban subdivisions. And many of the developers that used this financing were, for the first years of this program, until it became illegal in 1949, just outright discriminated. So they were essentially whites-only communities, and often the racial exclusions were in covenants attached to the deeds on these homes. And the most famous and infamous example of this is Levittown in Long Island, New York, and subsequently in New Jersey, where segregation was just a major feature of those communities, and one that was very, very strongly defended by the developers of those communities. And the Federal Housing Administration didn't just tolerate the discrimination and exclusion that their insurance fund was backing, but in fact perpetuated it by simultaneously excluding large areas of cities, and particularly majority-minority areas, and applicants very often from their funding and from their insurance fund. And there's certainly a lot of back and forth in the academic literature, on this history about whether government was following the private sector in these patterns and practices, or whether it was leading the way, but the result is the same. The government and the Federal Housing Administration played a really shameful role in promoting segregation, suburbanization, and disinvestment in cities.
That's the voice of journalist Alyssa Katz. She's the author of Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us, published by Bloomsbury. You're listening to Against the Grain, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So in the 1960s, there was, of course, a great deal of urban unrest, the civil rights movement, poverty, and the backlash of racism, including in Chicago, where in 1966 there was a riot. And policy wonks diagnose the problem as being at least partially about housing?
You know, it's interesting because it was the policy wonks in the form of the Kerner Commission on the riots, but it was also Martin Luther King's movement as well, and you know, Dr. King really brought attention to that subsequently with he brought his followers to Chicago specifically to protest conditions there, and housing conditions were really front and center. I mean, I think we're talking about just classic horrific slum conditions, housing that's just very poorly maintained and excessively expensive. Chicago has just had a terrible history of segregation where African American residents who had come up from the South looking for work were crowded into ghettos because they didn't have other places they were allowed to go, and making this even worse because African Americans did not have access to mortgage credit with which to buy homes, even if homes were available to them. Many turned to an underground real estate market, what's known as contract buying, so that white landlords using funds from the sort of elite of Chicago would buy up real estate and then essentially rent-to-own arrangement with these individual buyers, but at very, very high prices and on homes that were in really poor condition and for which the quote-unquote buyer was responsible for all the upkeep and repairs, but in fact didn't legally own and could lose without even making a payment. So all of this was kind of stirring in the cauldron during the riots in 1966. Candidate Percy, Charles Percy, who is a wealthy and successful business leader in the Chicago suburbs, had this idea that if residents in the inner city could only own their homes, that they wouldn't be as inclined to burn their neighborhoods down. He didn't literally say it that way, but that was pretty clearly the message. And I think he was, to his credit, extremely idealistic about this idea and really did see that a lack of access to capital and to credit was an incredibly destructive force in so many Chicago communities.
One of the things that I found fascinating in your book was the practice at this time of in Chicago and elsewhere of blockbusting. I think a lot of us have heard about the white flight to the suburbs in the 1960s in places like Chicago, but that actually there was a practice by real estate agents of approaching white homeowners in areas that were becoming integrated and scaring them about the specter of black hordes moving into their neighborhood and offering them money to move out right away. Tell us about that perhaps unknown part of this history.
Yeah, I mean, blockbusting was ubiquitous in many cities, and it went by many names. In Chicago, it was often called panic peddling. But the idea is that, in real estate, there's a lot of money to be made by turning over property, and, the real estate agents collect their fees, and the mortgage lender gets to make another loan. So what you had was pretty sleazy real estate operators coming into Chicago, and as you just said, on a pretty large scale, kind of block by block, almost in a kind of military style fashion, where they would target a block that they perceived as vulnerable, sort of on the leading edge of wherever the black population was expanding. They would go to white homeowners on those blocks, and usually when maybe the housewife was home by herself and perhaps feeling a little vulnerable, and scaring her. Saying that, your neighborhood is changing and your property values are going to go down, crime is going to go up, and don't you think you ought to leave now, soon, and here's the money to do it with. And because those households had access to the FHA backed mortgages with which they could, you know, that they could use to move to the suburbs, it was a really easy ticket out of there. And so this is why so many neighborhoods across, you know, in older cities across the country turned over so quickly, was that you had not just the pull of the suburbs and the financing to move there, but also this push from these organized rings of real estate agents.
The moral conscience, if I can put it that way, of your book seems to be this woman, Gail Sincotta, who was a community activist, a housewife and community activist in Chicago. What was her story?
Well, Gail was, she lived right in the middle of this whole story we've been telling. I mean, she lived in a Chicago neighborhood called Austin on the west side, where she had raised her six sons. And she began to see the consequences of all these incredibly destructive trends really coming home to roost in her neighborhood. And she also had been very involved in community organizing through an organization called the Organization for a Better Austin. And she had started by working in the schools, which had suddenly seen a horrendous crush of new kids, just totally overflowing the school, because so many families were moving into these rent-to-own houses and then had to double up because that was the only way to afford these extortionate payments that the landlord, that the owners, the sellers were demanding. So from there, you know, Gail Sincotta was always all about getting to the root causes of problems and organizing around attacking those causes. And she and others in Austin really, you know, came to understand that this problem wasn't about the schools. It was really about the housing and the fact that people couldn't get mortgage credit there. And more specifically, and we should not leave out a really important turning point in history that happened there, which is that because of what Senator Charles Percy did once he was in office, the Federal Housing Administration made some really, really pivotal and historic change in its policies in 1968, a little bit before then, but fully realized by 68. And that was that while they had excluded inner cities and inner city neighborhoods from their insurance program since its founding, they for the first time moved to make the program available pretty much everywhere, and especially, in fact, in areas that had been hit by rioting, which is great in theory and principle, and great in, you know, as Senator Percy had conceived it, but in practice under the brand new U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, very quickly under President Nixon, just turned into a horrific den of corruption. And so instead of helping the riot-torn neighborhoods rebuild, the FHA insurance program basically became a bankroll for massive criminal rings that took the whole blockbusting business model and just put it on steroids, using backed by the government money. And so what was happening in Gail Sincotta's neighborhood in Chicago was that she was seeing just, and her neighbors were seeing, just house after house and block after block just blighted with abandoned homes, pretty much through the same kinds of predatory lending and mortgage fraud schemes that have hit so many neighborhoods more recently in the subprime crisis. You know, what you had was these real estate investors, quote unquote, coming in and buying and selling the property to one another, or setting up a poor and vulnerable person with a mortgage they couldn't pay, so that then the real estate agent could then collect, or the lender could collect the insurance payment from the federal government. All kinds of schemes were going on, and very quickly they were leaving these neighborhoods just filled with homes that were sitting there rotting. And so Sincotta and her neighbors began to organize to fight this.
Yes, and in fact, sort of amazing, in an era before the internet, how they managed to organize both locally but also nationally.
Yeah, it is pretty amazing. I think I write in the book, that they, at one point, Sincada's now citywide group, it grew beyond the neighborhood, sent the interns out to O'Hare Airport to look for all the phone books from different cities and then look for names of organizations that might be neighborhood groups and then call them up, because that was the way that these groups nationally could find one another and begin to compare notes. And, you know, they ended up coming together first in Chicago and then pretty soon for various actions and meetings in Washington to really begin to hold HUD accountable for what its programs were doing to their neighborhoods.
And one of the things that ultimately came out of efforts of people like them was the 1977 Community Reinvestment Act. What was that?
Yes, this is really, you hear a lot about it now, and it's important to know the history. The Community Reinvestment Act is a regulation that applies to all federally regulated financial institutions, depository institutions that take deposits from customers. And it basically says that they need to meet the credit needs of the communities in which they operate. In other words, no longer could they as institutions do what they had done for decades and decide they wouldn't lend in certain neighborhoods. If they took deposits from customers in those neighborhoods, then they also had to make loans in those neighborhoods. And so it really brought in a kind of geographic test for the financial institutions where they had to be accountable to some degree for how they operated. And the idea was to really both encourage their best behavior and also shine a light through a related law called the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act on patterns of discrimination and exclusion, and then work to change those.
And yet Fannie Mae was not beholden to the Community Reinvestment Act. And perhaps we should backtrack for a moment and say that Fannie Mae was privatized by the Johnson administration in 1968, sold to shareholders to help finance the Vietnam War. So what was Fannie Mae's new position in this?
Yeah, no, Fannie took a really, really important turn in 1968. And, you know, it was privatized by Johnson both to finance the war, and I should add, that it also had the effect of getting all of the liabilities of Fannie Mae off of the government's balance sheet, right? So this became a kind of private concern and didn't add to the ballooning deficit that the Vietnam War was helping create. So what Fannie Mae suddenly needed to do as a private and now shareholder-owned entity was to make money very quickly and also build a market for itself and really begin to look for new opportunities. And nonetheless, even though it really did have this mandate, and in fact, a little footnote here, one of the ways they fulfilled that was by, in fact, investing in these sort of predatory mortgages that HUD was putting into neighborhoods like Yale Sincada's. But, more broadly, they continued as an institution to not allow did not accept mortgages that were made in communities where they didn't think those mortgages were a good risk.
So avoiding poor communities
right.
of color.
Avoiding poor communities and communities of color and not really doing any kind of meaningful risk analysis. It was really based a lot more on kind of received wisdom, sort of historic practice and all the discrimination that was embedded in those. And so what Sincada's organization ended up doing was really looking at Fannie next and saying, well, we've got this Community Reinvestment Act, but meanwhile it doesn't do as much good because the source of the mortgage loans, ultimately, the financing agency, is still following discriminatory practices. So they ended up sitting down with them and really coming to an understanding of, that Fannie Mae could start experimental new programs that would make credit available in ways that they hadn't in the past. and it would still represent really safe and careful underwriting and would not pose risks to the company, but at the same time would allow credit to be available in communities where it hadn't been previously.
That is the voice of journalist Alyssa Katz. We're going to take a music break and be back with her in a moment.
Saying in their sleep, oh, brother's got a date to keep, he can't hang around.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today I'm speaking with Alyssa Katz. She is a journalist and the author of Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us, published by Bloomsbury. We're discussing that today. She teaches journalism at NYU and writes for, amongst other publications, for Salon, Mother Jones, and the American Prospect. She also works with the Pratt Center for Community Development. And today we're discussing the history, much of it unsavory, of Wall Street and Washington's involvement in home ownership as part of the American dream. So before the break, Alyssa, you were summing up, leading us through the developments through the 1970s, which in many ways really laid the basis for the kind of crises, problems around housing that we've seen in recent years. And you write in the book, in Our Lot, that in the 1970s, in the context of the oil crisis, it was clear to those who invested in real estate that the suburbs really were not where it's at anymore, and that in fact a new market needed to be tapped into, and that was the market of the central cities themselves, including in these poor neighborhoods. This was the context in which a trader at the investment bank Salomon Brothers, Louis Ranieri, came up with a bright idea. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, you know, Ranieri had been trading for a while in securities that were made out of bunches of mortgages, which branch of federal government, the Federal Housing Administration, called Ginnie Mae, had actually been producing for a few years, starting in 1970. And Ranieri, I think, essentially thought, well, you know, this is all well and good that we're trading in these instruments that are produced by the federal government, but, like, gee, why can't we at Salomon Brothers create our own mortgage-backed securities? You know, I think he recognized before many others did, and, you know, his colleagues at Salomon recognized along with him, that the U.S. home mortgage market was a huge untapped business for Wall Street, that when you take this idea of taking the nation's mortgages, and you think there's, I think right now, you know, currently, I think I'm going to throw out numbers. I hope I'm getting them right. But, like, you know, you have upwards of 80 million homeowning households, and the majority of them have a mortgage on those homes, and almost everybody starts out with a mortgage on those homes. I mean, that is a massive, massive market in consumer debt, far bigger than anything else that's out there. And at the time, it was pretty much all managed by the federal government, and Wall Street could merely trade in it. So Ranieri began to figure out ways that Salomon Brothers could legitimately create its own mortgage-backed securities, which took quite a bit of work because the regulatory environment, you know, and this was the environment put in place following the Great Depression to make sure that the excesses of that, you know, of the 1920s didn't repeat themselves in the banking business, put a lot of restrictions on kind of just throwing together different types of assets and turning them into securities. And in fact, one reason those restrictions were in place was because the 20s had their own mortgage-backed securities market that was also a disaster. This was on apartment buildings, and led to a lot of limitations on who could invest in different types of securities and who could issue them and so on. So Ranieri set out to begin tearing down those Depression-era restrictions so that Salomon Brothers could trade in mortgages.
And he did it within a context which was very fortuitous for him, which was the election of Ronald Reagan and his agenda of deregulation and letting the market work its wonders.
Yeah, when Reagan came in, it was with, clearly a really ambitious agenda for financial deregulation. And housing was, from almost the beginning, a really central piece of it. Because I think that others, close to the administration saw the same thing that Ranieri did, that this was a potentially huge market, and it was one in which genuinely having some problems in the late 70s, stemming from incredibly high inflation during that period. That was just leaving the banking business in a pretty weak position and genuinely curtailing the quantity of mortgage credit out there. For Reagan's advisors, deregulation was sort of the answer to every problem. So clearly, this is the banking system was having trouble making home lending a viable business. Well, the solution was clearly deregulation. And so Ranieri began to work with the White House and with certain key advisors to the president, as well as with the president had a commission on housing and that looks at these same questions. And they recommended that pretty much the government make an exit from the mortgage business and that it be handed over exclusively to private investment banks like Salomon Brothers.
Right, very convenient, of course. Yet this push was not simply a Republican push. It was bipartisan. The Democrats backed this during the Reagan period, and then in 1996, when Clinton was reelected, he made home ownership a central part of his platform, which fit in with both a kind of earlier narrative around home ownership, but reinforced by Clinton's agenda around, quote, personal responsibility, which, of course, was seen in very stark terms with so-called welfare reform.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was really interesting to see how Clinton sort of discovered housing and, home ownership the way that so many other presidents have all sort of discovered home ownership as their salvation, because it is such a politically potent tool. And as I explained in the book, the Clinton campaign really had its origins in campaign politics. But from there, I think the administration really moved forward in a belief that home ownership on a large scale would be a win-win, that it would be something that could help people in financially vulnerable positions build economic power and at the same time, clearly be very lucrative for the private sector and particularly the financial institutions making the loans. And it's really in hindsight kind of remarkable given, the deregulatory environment that Clinton not only stepped into following Reagan and Bush 1, but then also promoted through, support for the end of Glass-Steagall, by keeping Alan Greenspan at the Federal Reserve.
And Glass-Steagall was separated the investment banks from regular banks.
Yeah, that's right. And I should explain, Glass-Steagall was another one of these, quaint Depression-era regulations that attempted to keep some order in the banking business by removing temptations for conflicts and corruption. And then, eventually Clinton also, of course, really endorsed the derivatives trade as well, to sort of even further turning finance into the Wild West. So it's kind of incredible that the Clinton administration, on the one hand, was really promoting home ownership as economic empowerment for essentially for low-income people, and at the same time was promoting a deregulatory environment that pretty much made those same people sitting ducks for whatever horrific financial product these companies wanted to throw at them.
And you quote those in government who have been working around housing issues, that they were told that they actually had to, they should be using the term affordable home ownership rather than affordable housing, which I thought was interesting manifestation of this change. Was there any evidence that home ownership makes for, taking the bait here, that home ownership makes for better neighborhoods, for more vibrant communities and so on, as Clinton and others were espousing?
Yeah, I mean, there's been an immense forest-killing body of research at this point on the benefits of home ownership. So I think the one thing that the research was able to conclude, you know, in the positive category, although it also has its negatives, is that homeowners do tend to stay in one place for longer than people who don't own their homes, which isn't surprising because, you know, with home ownership comes certain constraints on mobility, and you have to spend money to get out of it, you know, with various fees you're paying to a realtor and so on. So from staying in one place for a long time, one does have certain associated effects of, like, you know, being more involved in community affairs. Gardening apparently is you know, homeowners are more likely to garden. And there's all kinds of effects that researchers have measured that seem to be attributable in some way to home ownership, and not, you know, of course, the other way around, that people who garden or join civic groups or so on, you know, might have a propensity in the first place to be a homeowner.
So it's a self-selected group, perhaps.
Exactly, a self-selected group, and so it's very hard to conclude anything. But I think also the literature really kind of overlooked a downside. You know, it's sort of, the literature always elevated civic engagement and involvement as a really worthy achievement. But you have to realize that the civic engagement and involvement of homeowners is very geared around protecting property values, and that can also lead to very destructive outcomes, including, you know, exclusion and discrimination. And this is really coming to the fore now, you know, as we have areas that have pretty much zoned out affordable housing and any kind of diversity, because owners there want to, you know, protect the scarcity of housing and protect their property values.
I'm speaking with Alyssa Katz. She teaches journalism at NYU and is the author of Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us. I'm Sasha Lilly, and the program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. Well, taking things up to the present, where we've seen, of course, an absolutely spectacular meltdown of the housing market with terrible consequences all throughout the country. So obviously in the 1990s, along with Clinton pushing home ownership and the kind of marketization of this, there was the emergence of subprime loans. And at the same time, Alan Greenspan kept interest rates low, and following the dot-com burst in particular, there was, you know, this real surge in people buying houses as investments, even if they were enormously expensive. Can you sum up for us the main dynamics at work in the past decade and how they brought all these threads together, which you've been narrating in the explosive mix that we've seen?
Yeah, I mean, clearly a lot went into it. But I think the main thing we saw happen is that, you know, you had in the 90s, you know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac as the main government-backed sources of mortgage credit still kept the market fairly disciplined, and it didn't really mess with highly risky types of lending. It was still a mission-driven. These are mission-driven institutions, so they were mandated to make home ownership widely available, and they did it on pretty productive terms. But what you saw in the 90s was the emergence of, for the first time, of subprime lending. which was an almost entirely Wall Street-backed business. They were kind of taking the business that Fannie and Freddie wouldn't and couldn't touch.
And these are basically risky mortgages.
They're mortgages that in various ways, sometimes it's because of the credit of the borrower, but sometimes it's because of totally other reasons having to do with just how the mortgages are put together and what the property itself, what its stats, and value are. And, so that there was, these lenders over time that Delta and Subprime were able to build a pretty robust market on Wall Street through these mortgages. They yielded pretty high returns for investors because of the risks. So what you saw happen really after 2001, when, as you just explained, you had the dot-com crash and low interest rates and 9/11 and all this, these sort of catalyzing events, is you had these private market actors, the Wall Street investment banks coming in and looking to build their market share in this business. And they were really increasingly driven as well by a demand coming via derivatives, right? Sort of even higher yielding investments in the riskiest parts of their mortgage pools. But the thing is that in order to grow, which is what they were out to do, there were only two things that those investment banks could do, and both of them were really destructive, from like 2002 to 2007. And one thing they could do was start stealing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's customers by basically taking prime, qualified, customers and convincing them to take out a subprime mortgage, even though it's more expensive, and much more risky. And they did this through various predatory lending practices, sort of out from their frontline troops, mortgage brokers in neighborhoods, who didn't work for these lenders directly, but were selling their products on a massive scale. So you had a huge growth in that kind of business. And at the same time, the lenders were also just really looking to, in addition to stealing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's business, they were also just bringing in new homeowners into the mix by kind of just aggressively lowering their lending standards. And so what you eventually saw among subprime lenders and the investment banks that backed them was a race to the bottom, where in order to compete for market share, they kept making riskier and riskier and riskier mortgages to people who were either borrowing way too much or had problems on their credit, or where there were just other issues with how the deal was being made, but we're making those deals anyway because they could just sell those mortgages off to investors. Of course, what resulted from this cycle and from what seemed to be a never ending appreciation of real estate values was kind of from there you really got into bubble behavior, where a lot of players out there, including those buying the real estate, were buying it not to live in, but just as an investment. The idea that, like on those reality shows, that they would flip this house and make money off of whoever would buy it down the line. So, one thing that really comes across in my book, is sort of how multifaceted the bubble really was, and how it's really impossible to kind of sum it up in any one story. Mm-hmm. There were so many different experiences in different places and among different types of buyers and lenders that what I do in the book is really look for instance in Sacramento.
Right, and I wonder if you could tell us about, because obviously this is a story close to home for our listeners, but Lennar Corporation played a particularly noxious role in the real estate debacle there.
Yes. That's right. And Lennar also has a big, big Bay Area project.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's, in my book, I use Lennar Corporation as an example. You know, there are others very much like this. Sort of new breed in the home building business. Many of you may not realize it, but home building has gone from being kind of like a father and son business to a big publicly traded industry where, you know, making quarterly numbers for shareholders is the goal. And it's a goal that the home builders pursued very, very aggressively over the past 15 years. And this is why, you know, California was a very big play field and is a big playing field for these companies, why you saw such aggressive development of subdivisions on the outer fringes of areas like Sacramento and Bakersfield and so on, you know, is that you had a lot of these companies, as well as the smaller local players, all in a kind of Darwinian, you know, competition to see who could get their product out there and move it. And they were able to do that with all of this credit coming in from Wall Street.
So finally, I wanted to end by asking you, what is the solution here? You write about growing up yourself in a rent-controlled apartment in New York. And as you write, your family would no more think of owning one's own house as owning a tractor. And yet there's been, obviously, culturally, huge pressure for people to buy their houses, and they get, you know, a tax deduction on them, whether, in fact, they live in those houses or not. So is the answer here that there should be assistance to poor people, as we hear, to own their own houses? Or should we really be thinking differently about home ownership and about being renters?
Yeah, no, I think you can't really look at this problem without looking at how renters are treated in the U.S., which is in really striking contrast to other parts of the world that also saw real estate, a real estate bubble, but have just not had the kind of foreclosure crisis that we have here in the U.S. And I really do attribute it, at least in part, to the different treatment of renters in, you know, especially in Europe, where renting or owning is a choice. Owning is not an obligation. You know, it's something that should be available. Ownership should be available to anyone who does have some, you know, has adequate means to pay for their home. But renters need better protections. You know, they need to know they can get a renewal lease at the end of their term. They have to know that when they have an issue with their landlord, that they can go to court and exercise some meaningful rights. And as I explained in the book, the reason that my husband and I decided to buy after being lifelong renters was because, thanks to deregulation in New York State, we and essentially found ourselves unprotected for the first time, and our building, you know, turned into a condo. And while we considered renting again after leaving there, we just decided we did not want to put ourselves into that vulnerable position that we would buy solely to get that housing security. And we really shouldn't have had to make that choice. And I think the one other thing that really biases behavior and you know, in the U.S. and really sets up renters to fail is that homeowners get a massive deduction on their taxes for their home mortgage interest. And this essentially becomes a redistributive benefit that only goes to homeowners and relatively wealthy homeowners at that. So it's another policy that provides no public benefit. It just makes real estate more expensive, but it is, you know, it's sort of unconscionable to say to low and moderate income Americans, well, you just can go ahead and rent, when owners do get so many benefits that renters don't.
And that was a conversation I had earlier this year with journalist Alyssa Katz. She's the author of Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us. That's published by Bloomsbury Books, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. And you have been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again tomorrow. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. please visit us on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio, submit comments, and find ways to reach us. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670, or consider becoming a fan of Against the Grain Radio on Facebook. And I'd like to thank our engineer today, Veronica Faison.